The White House responds to Iran putting morality police back on the streets. We assess the Iranian president's rare Africa tour last week with the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think everyone is using this trip to position themselves as finding, you know, alternatives and rescues for their own economic woes.
Plus, a former Israeli military spokesman tells us how Israel determined that Iran is smuggling weapons to the West Bank.
From what the Iranians are saying, from what our intelligence suggests, and from what these militant or the terrorist organizations are claiming for themselves.
And nations who lost citizens in Iran's 2020 shootdown of a Ukrainian passenger plane ask the International Court of Justice to intervene. We get reaction from a group of victims' relatives. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran has restarted nationwide deployments of its morality police for the first time since their arrest of an Iranian Kurdish woman last September sparked months of mass protests against the nation's Islamist rulers. On Sunday, a spokesman for Iran's Law Enforcement Command said the morality police would resume foot and vehicle patrols to enforce an Islamist dress code requiring women to cover their hair with a hijab in public. Images posted on social media showed the officers back on duty in Tehran and elsewhere on Monday. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell asked U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby at a Monday press briefing what leverage the U.S. has to counter Iran's move.
Well, as you know, we've already sanctioned members of the morality police. We've sanctioned some entities that have supported the activities of the so-called morality police. It's already led to the death of one young woman and the injury and wounding of countless others, men and women. Iranian women should be able to decide for themselves how they're going to observe their faith and how they're going to dress in public. And nothing's changed about our stance on that. And we'll watch this closely. And if we believe that more accountability needs to be had, if we believe that we need to take additional action to put more pressure on the regime, then we'll do that.
That was National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications, John Kirby. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi returned to Tehran on Friday from a rare three-nation tour of Africa, the first to the continent by an Iranian head of government in a decade. Raisi started the tour in Kenya before moving on to Uganda and finishing in Zimbabwe. He met the leaders of all three nations as part of Tehran's diplomatic campaign to break out of isolation by the West. Michelle Gavin is an Africa analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Botswana. I asked her by phone what kind of message Raisi's trip sends to Washington.
Well, I think the tour serves as a reminder that should not be needed, but probably is, that African states have a wide variety of external suitors, potential partners who are interested in access and in influence in the region. So sometimes the U.S.-Africa community tends to think in very binary terms about U.S.-China or increasingly U.S.-Russia. And this is just a reminder that there's a multiplicity of actors out there and that African states, many of which are struggling in the aftermath of the pandemic, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has driven up prices, they're dealing with debt burdens. They are interested in a variety of overtures that may come their way if it even gives the appearance of providing some kind of economic relief.
Well, what is appealing to these African countries when it comes to Iran? What can it give them?
Well, good question. It was interesting to see in the press coverage of this trip, the many announcements of MOUs, very few numbers attached to any of the talk about investment.
Yeah, you noticed that as well.
Yes. And I do think, you know, it's a mixed bag of countries here. So, you know, Zimbabwe's agenda is going to be different from Kenya's, right? For Zimbabwe, a chance to associate themselves to some degree with Iran and to try to latch on to this notion of sort of sanctioned victims of the West, even though the sanctions regime in Zimbabwe is completely different. It's a set of targeted individuals and entities. There's no kind of blanket prohibition on trade investment in Zimbabwe. But it serves the Zimbabwean government to pretend that there is, to pretend that the gross economic mismanagement in that country is a function of sanctions, right? So they have a more kind of complicated agenda that's about how they want to sort of position themselves as victims of the West. You know, for a Kenya who is not interested in that kind of positioning, right, I think the Ruto administration is largely thinking about the cost of living crisis in the country, the economic squeeze that they're experiencing, and a chance to talk about the prospect, right, of exporting Kenyan tea and whatnot to another market is an opportunity not to be passed up, perhaps, from their perspective. And then, of course, in Uganda, you had a very interesting emphasis on a shared perspective on LGBT issues. So the Ugandan government recently passed some very draconian legislation criminalizing same-sex relationships and adding these very draconian penalties, life imprisonment, even capital punishment in some cases. And President Museveni of Uganda has been moving further away from the West as his regime grows more authoritarian and there's more condemnation coming his way for the violence and repression that's become a feature of the political landscape. So finding some sense of solidarity with another country serves some political purpose there.
The Iranian state media were saying after President Raisi returned to Tehran that he actually proposed bartering with these three African nations so that Iran could provide petrochemicals to them in return for basic goods that Iran needs. In terms of what Iran might get out of these three countries, you know, how realistic do you think is this kind of bartering mechanism?
I have doubts about how realistic that is. You know, I think everyone is using this trip, which may have very little in the way of kind of concrete results, to position themselves as finding, you know, alternatives and rescues for their own economic woes. So I think that happens on both sides of this kind of Africa-Iran engagement.
President Raisi also was emphasizing trying to have solidarity against unilateralism. And that seems to be a euphemism for what he sees as unilateralist Western policies. To what extent can Raisi succeed in getting these countries in Africa and maybe even others to join this kind of alliance against so-called unilateralism?
Well, I think, you know, as you see the way the South Africans talk about BRICS, for example, there certainly are African voices who sort of are asserting that the international order is too dominated by the West, that there needs to be a sort of deliberate effort to push back. So I think, you know, where Iran fits into that, I think, would be kind of a case-by-case judgment of kind of different African states and the costs and benefits of that kind of association. But there's nothing new under the sun about a dialogue in Africa about resisting unilateralism, right? That's not a new element or something that would be novel in any way.
Well, Ambassador Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us on the line from New York City. Thanks so much for coming on to Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
Israel says Iran has been increasing its support to Palestinian terror groups in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, from where they have carried out a series of deadly attacks on Israeli civilians in recent months. Israel has carried out multiple raids on militant strongholds in the West Bank to try to deter the attacks. Israeli observers say Iran appears to be smuggling weapons to the West Bank militants from Jordan, which is at peace with Israel. One of those observers is Jonathan Conricus, a former Israeli military international spokesman and a lieutenant colonel in reserves. I sat down with him near Washington on Monday and asked how he knows Iran's fingerprints are on those weapons.
From what the Iranians are saying, from what our intelligence suggests, and from what these militant or the terrorist organizations are claiming for themselves. We also have chatter in Hamas saying that they are now diverting some of the what they call aid or the sustenance that they are given by the Iranians. They are diverting it to northern Samaria, to Judea and Samaria. Hamas is saying that. The Iranians are boasting about it themselves. And at the end of the day, what Iranians are doing is they're smuggling across the border. It's hundreds of kilometers of, let's say, not very well protected borders.
The Israel-Jordan border.
Israel-Jordan border, we mentioned topography. So, you know, all of our other borders, Lebanon, Golan Heights, Gaza, and also with Egypt, which is about 200-mile border, we have lots of cameras, sensors, motion detectors, radars, lots of tech. And on the Jordanian border, that unfortunately isn't the situation.
And why is that?
Again, because up until now, it's been a quiet border and it's been a very peaceful and well-protected border on both sides.
It's mostly a river, isn't it? It's the Jordan River.
There's the Jordan River, but it's, you know, not a river in American sense.
More like a stream.
It's a stream. It's a small stream. You can cross it easily by foot. And it's more of a psychological obstacle than of a real obstacle. And very clearly crossable for anybody who knows the lay of the land, has ties on both sides, and has a mission to do. And usually these smugglers are very well compensated by the Iranians and by their Palestinian receivers. And they really have an incentive to get the job done and smuggle weapons and money across.
So are smugglers crossing from the Jordanian side of that border into Israel proper and then somehow getting into the West Bank, or are they going straight into the West Bank?
No, they're going straight into the West Bank. Many times they're aided by Bedouins who live in the Jordan Valley on the Israeli side. There's quite a lot of Bedouin communities and Bedouin villages. They usually are shepherds and know the terrain very well, very intimately. So we've seen a few instances of that happening as well. And today I think that there are, you know, there's an established network of Palestinians who have access to the Israeli side of the border. And again, for those who don't have, you know, the map in front of us, northern Samaria or the West Bank, it's one unit and there's no borders or fences or any obstacles to get from a Palestinian city to the Israeli-Jordanian border. So theoretically speaking, somebody who knows the lay of the land or the area well from Nablus, he can travel from Palestinian-controlled Nablus, get very close to the border with Jordan, and then the Jordanian smuggler will provide the goods from there and a transaction will be made.
Are weapons actually taken over the river or over
yes.
the stream?
Yes.
And hand-to-hand transaction yeah. is done?
Very old-fashioned, like you'd imagine, you know, like maybe decades ago, but that's how it's done. Packages are delivered and weapons go across the Jordan River and they eventually end up in the hands of Palestinian militant organizations.
Why isn't there some kind of barrier that Israel would put up like it has done along its other frontiers? Why isn't there such a boundary or barrier on the Israeli-controlled side of the Jordan River?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's I think, purely an issue of budget and national priorities. A quick recap of the other fences that Israel built along our borders. It took official Israel about 30,000 to 50,000 illegal immigrants coming in from Sinai. Most of them were African work seekers, illegal work seekers who infiltrated into Israel through Sinai. It took Israel a few years of that reality until that changed. And Israel decided to build a fence along that border, substantial financial investment. But as soon as that fence was built, the amount of illegals getting in dropped to zero within less than a year. We have a strong fence on the Golan Heights, which was built after the war in Syria started and the security situation changed and it became a very dangerous place where there was constant attempts to cross into Israel and harm Israeli civilians. And we have a strong obstacle in Gaza and with Lebanon. The common denominator is a certain need for it. And if we look, you know, a few months or a year in the future, I think that there will be a demand for Israel to establish that kind of hardware and infrastructure along at least parts of the Jordanian border as well, because otherwise I don't see the flow of weapons stopping.
When it comes to the flow of weapons, if the weapons are going from Jordan into the West Bank, then one wonders how they're getting into Jordan. And are these weapons that are, let's say, manufactured in Iran and then somehow taken into Jordan? Or is Iranian money just sort of paying for weapons that are already in Jordan or coming from somewhere else?
So a lot of what I've seen, and if you analyze videos by the different militant organizations, the different new terrorist organizations that exist, you'll see a lot of what looks to be American hardware. You'll see M4 rifles, you'll see different American equipment. You don't see the old Kalashnikovs and the AK-47s and Russian or Soviet hardware. You see American-made hardware. And I've read Intel reports indicating that a lot of weapons are weapons that the Americans brought to Iraq and then provided Iraqi forces and other friendly forces with, and were then sold or taken or stolen or whatever by different terrorist organizations. And Iran is very strong in Iraq today, and they are experts at building proxies, at arming proxies, and at gun running. They have a very long track record of that. So what you can see, again, based on the videos publicly available of these organizations, it looks as if they have Western-made military-grade weapons, not made in China and not made in Iran.
That is really interesting. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel in Reserves Jonathan Conricus.
Thank you.
The former international spokesperson for the Israel Defense Forces, joining us here in Arlington, Virginia. Great to have you on Flashpoint Iran.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. A group of relatives of those killed when Iran shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane taking off from Tehran in January 2020 has welcomed a move by four governments to take the case to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. The four nations that lost citizens in the shootdown, Britain, Canada, Sweden, and Ukraine, made the move on July 5th. They accused Tehran of violating its international obligations in relation to the incident that killed all 176 people on board. Iran says its forces mistakenly fired on the plane because they thought it was a U.S. missile. Kurosh Duschanas is the Canada-based spokesman for the Association of Families of Flight PS752 victims. I asked him in a phone call what role his group will have in the ICJ process.
Well, our association will continue to emphasize what is important for us, because what we heard from the other side, they try to put the emphasis on compensation. And they've been trying to, by putting emphasis on compensation, avoid talking or providing answer and be truthful, and also not done any meaningful prosecution. So that is really what is a big difference. And we are not really looking for compensation at this point, as the important steps first to know the truth. And then we see the justice is being done, because these are absolutely important for families, because without knowing the truth and seeing the justice, we will not have any closure in our lives of after losing our loved ones. And these are absolutely important for all the families.
The association also has been pursuing this case through another international legal body, the International Criminal Court, or ICC. What can you tell our listeners about how that process is going, and how is it different from the ICJ process?
Well, ICJ process has been a state-to-state dispute mechanism. Basically, the four countries are asking Iran specific questions and the specific performance of what they need to be done, and Iranian side has not fulfilled those things. And we were just supporting the procedure between the state-to-state. Basically, in this case, there are four states versus Iran. But in ICC, it's International Criminal Court, which we, through our lawyers, we submitted a letter and we requested basically the prosecutor general of ICC to take up this case, we are demanding and we're asking for criminal investigation to the case, independent criminal investigation, because there are definitely criminal aspects of this case. And there are people who knew what they were doing at the time they were shooting down the plane. And we'd like to know why they did it and what is the reason for that and why they didn't do whatever they needed to do after shooting down the plane, like namely securing the crash site and securing and treating the victims' bodies with dignity. You know, they completely failed to do their obligations.
What can you share about the latest developments in this case with the ICC?
Well, the ICC, since we submitted our case to them on September 14th last year, we are in a holding pattern. And we have requested all the countries signatory to the Rome Statutes, which is really governing the ICC court, to support the family associations of PS752 legal submission. And to this day, unfortunately, we haven't received any support from any country. And we really, we were hoping the other independent countries who are interested to see into this kind of terrorist activities to come forward and support our ICC case.
Given that you have four countries that just submitted an application to the ICJ, why wouldn't any of those countries also support the ICC case that you submitted?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, we have been trying to find out for ourselves why some of these countries are reluctant to support this case in ICC. Because at the end of the day, there is an open investigation for war crimes, which covers the territory of Ukraine. And the flight PS752 was a plane that was registered in Ukraine. And as such, it was considered under an international law as a part of Ukraine territory. So if they are doing all kinds of investigation for war crimes, why not also look into this and at least do the investigation?
What do you think is going to happen next with the ICC? You say you're in a holding pattern. Are you waiting for someone to take action?
Well, we will continue asking through our lawyers to bring it to their attention, to the ICC prosecutor, and asking them if there is anything else they need, any kind of support from the family association or anywhere else. We are ready to help. But we understand they are overwhelmed with all kinds of investigation they are taking currently. Namely, all the investigation they have in Ukraine is going on and all the atrocities in everywhere else. But we don't want our case to be forgotten. We want to make sure this will be considered and taken care of too. And this is the obligation, not only on ICC, but all the countries who are signatory to ICC to also put their effort to bring this case forward and prosecute this case after they doing the proper investigation. Because shooting down flight PS752 has not been properly investigated and the investigation need to be done first. We are aware there is a criminal investigation happening in Ukraine. It's been going on past more than 2 years. But unfortunately, when it was really, really taking many steps forward in March of 2022, Russian invasion has slowed down that process. So currently there is no, probably I shouldn't say, there is an active investigation, but it's not been resourced properly, is not having enough of resources to allow it to go forward.
Well, Kurosh Dushchanas, spokesperson for the Association of the Families of Flight PS752 Victims, thank you so much for bringing all of us up to date on the efforts of your group, and please do keep us posted.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for continuing covering the story. This is very important for the freedom of everyone and the safety of everyone.
That's a wrap of the show. I'm Michael Lippin.
great that you could join us, and please do so again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.